Welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm Ann Gordon here with my friend and chavruta Yardena Osband. Our daf of the day, Masechet Bava Metzia, daf bet. Page 2. We're in the second section of the big tractate that was once upon a time called Nezikin, meaning damages, which is its own tractate nowadays. It has 10 chapters the same way that the previous Bava Kama also had 10 chapters. And we're going to see that it has different themes, different issues, right? Maybe we're going to see pretty quickly that, you know, we'll continue with issues of personal property, but we also will delve into business, right? Certain issues within business that we haven't talked about yet. And we are going to see more about lost and found and what happens with transfer of animals and what happens with when people don't treat each other kindly, right? Meaning there's all kinds in a civil law kind of way. And some of those issues that happen if you are a business owner or if you have employees and how much do you have to feed your workers or do you have to feed them and so on. We're going to see more, of course, of lending and borrowing, meaning many of the topics that we've seen are going to come up, and they're going to come up in different ways because they're not really the same topics. Okay, so I want to give a brief introduction to this chapter, meaning that's the whole Masechet Bava Metzia. Again, Bava means sha'ar, meaning gate, and it just means like an entrance into this topic, and Metzia means middle, right? Bava Kama was the first one, Bava Batra means after, and this is the middle one. So it's not very exciting as far as Masechet names go. I think we've mentioned that this also happens in Masechet Kelim, where also there's like 30 chapters, but we don't have Gemara on that in the same way, so that it doesn't feel as weighty, maybe. I do think that people acknowledge that these Masechtot, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Batra, are kind of like the backbone of a good portion of Talmudic study and Jewish law, right? Because this is the civil law, as opposed to ritual, Shabbat, the holidays, and so on. And all the laws of marriage and divorce, which we've already addressed a lot of them through Seder Nashim, again, it's kind of its own topic, its own bubble. This is, I think, more wide-ranging and more applicable to kind of everybody at some point. Not that everybody will have all these same jobs or these same roles, but you're going to encounter something having to do with civil law at some point or another. Okay, I want to address, just as I said, just briefly, chapter 1. Why this particular chapter, and Yardena, I know you're going to do the mission in just a moment, it begins with a lost item, and then it is found, and two people find it and claim it to be theirs at the same time. And I have to say that somebody sent me, I guess, a meme, a joke, whatever, today, which was that it's a picture of the Masechet, the tractate of Bava Metzia, and two people grabbing a hold of it, each one saying, it's mine, and the other guy saying, no, it's mine. And I feel like it was exactly appropriate because there were very scarce Bava Metzias for purchase, at least in Jerusalem, of late, because everybody's embarking on the new daf, the new Masechet for the new daf. And it was so on target that you know, it just made me laugh. And you'll see, you know, as your data gets into the mystery, you'll see even more why that is. What's going to happen, though, is that the question of who has the right to something when it seems that both people have a legitimate claim becomes a really important discussion. And we're going to see that that's going to carry on, not just the Mishnah. It's going to go on for quite a while. I think that works as an intro. Yardena, can I turn it over to you? I think we'll have more to discuss as we go.
You can turn it over to me. And in typical fashion, Bava Metzia seems to start in the middle of a case. Shnaim ochazim b'talit. So two people are basically holding a garment, right? Like two of them are pick up the same object, right? Zeomer ani matzatiha, zeomer ani matzatiha. One says, I found it. The other one says, I found it. Zeomer kulashali, zeomer kulashali. One says, all of this is mine. The other one says, all this is mine. Ze yishave she'en lo ba pachot michatzia. Ze yishave she'en lo ba pachot michatzia. B'yachaloko. So each one basically has to take an oath that he doesn't have ownership of less than half of it. And then they basically divide it. It sounds like a very, you know, sort of King Solomon way of dealing with this talit that they're both fighting over. Zemer kula shali, v'zemer chetzia shali. But let's say one of the litigants says, all of it is mine, and the other one says, half of it is mine. So basically, at this point, they agree that half of the cloak belongs to one of them. Half of this talit belongs to one of them. Ha'omer kula shali, yishavesh she'en lo bapachot mishlo shachalakim. So the one who said, all of it is mine, has to take an oath that he does not own less than three parts of it. In other words, that he owns at least three fourths of it. Ba'omer chetzio shelo, yishavesh she'en lo pachot, and the one who says that half of it is mine, he doesn't have ownership of less than a quarter of it. And then when they split it, they're going to give three fourths and a quarter. Now, again, this is a very interesting Mishnah, because what are you supposed to do with three fourths of a talit or a cloak, right? Like, that's assuming you cut it up. So, like, what are you really left with? Just some fabric. The Mishnah then gets to another case. So now we have a case of two people are riding or sitting on the back of an animal, or one was sitting, like riding on the animal, the other one's leading the animal. And again, each one says that all the animal is theirs. Right. So each one takes an oath that they don't own less than half of it, and they have to divide it. Again, we're going to have to see, how do you actually divide this? When they admit to the validity of each other's claims, or when they have witnesses for their claims, they divide the item without taking an oath. So an oath is only taken when there's no way to prove somebody's claim. And this is basically the beginning of this parak. Now, it's an interesting way to begin, because what the second parak is going to talk about is the halachot of what happens when you return lost items, which actually would seem like a continuation of what we were learning in Bava Kamma. And here we're going to have a whole parak basically devoted to how do we determine ownership of items when two people claim to have the items. Now, the Gemara is going to begin with a question, which is, if you saw the beginning of the Mishnah, right? It starts off by saying, Ani matzatia v'zeh me ani matzatia, right? Each one says, I found it. And then it says, each one says, kula shali. So the Gemara's obvious question is, Lama li limitna zeh omer ani matzatia v'zeh omer ani matzatia zeh omer kula shali v'zeh omer kula shali. Why does the Mishnah need to teach both? Why do we have to say, I found it, and the other one says, I found it? And that one says, all of it is mine. And that one says, all of it is mine. Litna chada, right? Just teach one of it, right? Like, you just need, the point is just that both of them claim ownership. Why do you need both of those specific clauses? Chada ktani, zeh omer ani matzatia v'kula shali, v'zeh omer ani matzatia v'kula shali. So first the Gemara says by saying, right, maybe the way to understand the Mishnah is that what it is that the claim of each person is saying, I found it, all of it is mine. And the other one says, I found it, all of it is mine. But the Gemara again says, V'line ani mitzatia, v'ana yadana tukula shali. But again, you could just teach, I found it. And then the understanding is, you own all of it, right? You're saying, kula shali. Itna ani mitzatia, have amina, right? So the Gemara basically says, if the Tana basically taught, I found it, right? I would say, my mitzatia is the meaning of mitzatia ra'atiha, right? It could just mean that I saw it. So maybe what he's saying is I saw the object first, but it doesn't necessarily mean afalgav the love atalide briyab almakani, right? That even though he didn't actually take possession of it yet, he hasn't made a formal kinyan on it yet, he acquired it just through seeing it. Tna kula shali debriya lo kani. So by saying that all of it is mine, it teaches that one doesn't acquire something just by seeing it. Umi matzeit amrit mai matzatia ra'atiha, v'ha amar ravani umitzatia da'ata lide mashma. So the Gemara goes to challenge this and say, how can you say that the term I found it means I saw it, right? Didn't Rabbeinu say, right, when he interpreted a verse, and here they quote a pasuk from Devarim chapter 22, verse 3 that says, and you found it, means that it came into your possession, right? So in other words, we never say that seeing something claims ownership. It has to be that it actually came into your possession. So I'm going to stop here because there's a lot to digest here. But essentially what the Gemara is going to initially do is try to understand what is the difference between these phrases of mitzatia and kula shali, and why do we need both of them, right? And again, this is a very typical Gemara discussion because the Gemara believes, as we've seen time and time again, that the Mishnah is not constructed in a haphazard way. Rather, the language of the Mishnah is very carefully crafted. And so therefore, the Gemara needs to understand why is this particular language used in order to understand this part, in order to set up or to teach this particular scenario.
I think also it's kind of like, I don't know, if we were ended Bava Metzia talking about ownership, and now we open Bava Metzia talking about ownership, but we're talking about contested ownership, and we're talking about how do you get to the truth, right? Like, I feel like there's so much going on in this first daf of this new Masechet, because on the one hand, it's kind of a classic case. It's a classic case of an argument that needs adjudication, that needs halacha, as opposed to just, don't worry about it, you'll figure it out, right? There needs to be a plan, and sometimes judges, and certainly, you know, who has the right, and so on. And then on the other hand, what's really going on is getting to the truth, which is, I don't know, in a different kind of way than we usually talk about, kind of the crux of a good portion of religion, of being a good person. Like, all of those things depend on making sure that you're honest when you come to this. I do think that our two guys hanging on to the talit, each of them is sincere, right? There's not, that's where it becomes tricky. If you could just say, oh, you're lying, I got here first, then it would be an easy solve.
Right. And I think here the issue is that there is no way to prove it. And that's exactly the point why they have to take an oath, because there aren't any witnesses, right? It's really just like a he said, he said. They both have a valid claim, and therefore there's no really good way to parse out who actually owns this object.
That's our DAF discussion for the day. Thank you for joining us. Rank us, review us where you get your podcasts. Come talk to us on our Facebook page and tell us what you think of this DAF. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. And until tomorrow, go and learn.
Hello and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts here, Dana Azman, here with my friend Chavruta and Gordon. Our daf today, Masechet Bava Metzia, daf hey, page 5. Well, pretty much since we began this Masechet, we've been dealing with Rabbi Chia and his Kal Vachomer, and we've been introduced to a concept from Rabbi Chia of Moda B'Miksat. The idea being that if you can partially substantiate a claim by witnesses, it creates a scenario of moda b'miksat, which is a way of sort of proving that maybe the claim is actually true, all right? Or at least that you can substantiate that part of the claim is true. And so what begins to finally happen on this daf is, after we've done all of this work on what is Rabbi Chiya's opinion, how does he develop a kal v'chomer, different proofs for it, different ways of understanding it, we finally have a case. And the Gemara wants to work through this case and see if Rabbi Chiya's understanding of moda b'miksat with witnesses applies here. Hahu raya. So there was a shepherd. Dehave maser le kol yom chivata besade. So every day, like the people who lived wherever he lived, right, they would, in front of witnesses, would give him animals each day, right? So the idea is that people would drop his animals off, and there were witnesses to see that the animals were there. And this way, when they came back at the end of the day to take the animals back, the witnesses could say, hey, this person gave you their sheep, this person gave you their sheep. He wouldn't be able to steal any of the animals. Yom achad masrule below sade. One day they delivered witnesses to him without any witnesses. L'sofam ralehu, and then at the end of that day, when people came to get their animals back, he says, lo hayu dvarim me'olam, this never happened. And there were no witnesses that day to say that those animals were delivered. Atu sade asidu bay. But witnesses did come and testify, de'achol tarte minhu, that he ate two of the animals that day. So that basically establishes that he did receive at least two of the animals that people, of all the animals that people claimed that he had.
So Rabbi Zera looks at this case and he says, I'm a Rabbi Zera. Im ita lida Rabbi Chia kamate. If Rabbi Chia's first law is accepted, right, the idea that you can have moda b'miksat situation because you have a partial substantiation by witnesses, mishtava ashrai, then he has to swear with about the remaining animals, right? Because, in other words, the shepherd basically has to say, you know, he has to basically deny that he didn't get any of those other animals. The witnesses say, hey, you got those two animals. They were given to you to eat. He ate them. Or, you know, or he has to pay them back because he actually was supposed to shepherd them and he ate them. Fine. But that is because there's a moda b'miksat situation here, because the witnesses can substantiate that he did receive some animals. He now has to take a shvua to basically say those are the, I don't know anything about the other animals that everybody's claiming. Now, Abaye doesn't agree with this. Amar le Abaye. Abaye says to Rabbi Zera, im atay mishtaba, if Rabbi Chia's first, you know, if Rabbi Chia's opinion is accepted, the shepherd swears, right? How could this be? Vaha gazlan hu. Really, he's a thief. And a thief doesn't ever actually take an oath. In other words, what we know is that the shepherd basically stole two of the animals, right? We know that because it was established by witnesses who saw him eating it. So he's disqualified from actually swearing. What Rabbi is trying to say is that when we have Rabbi Chia's law here, that if you have a partial substantiation by witnesses, it's considered moda b'miksat, right? It's where his claim, his denial of the claim, right, is only partially contradicted by the witnesses, right? So, for example, let's say somebody says, you owe me 100 zoos, right? And the defendant come and he says, you know, no, I don't owe you anything. And then witnesses come and say, no, you actually owed 50 zoos. So it's possible in that case, he didn't actually mean to say that he didn't want to pay anything at all, but he's just stalling so that he could eventually find the money to pay what he could pay, right? Or if a litigant, you know, denies actually receiving an object that he was supposed to watch, and then witnesses come and say, you know, no, he did receive, you know, let's say he was given two objects, right? And then witnesses come and say he was given at least one. It doesn't mean that he actually stole it, right? It could mean that maybe the other object was lost. Or again, he's stalling for time so he can pay the owner back. But this case of the shepherd, he's like outright lying. He's saying nobody gave him anything, right? Like he's outright lying that anything happened. And there's no way to explain it. So that's what Abaye is saying. Like, he's just a thief. So why? And we know that in those cases, he doesn't act, and a thief never takes an oath. So Rabbi Zera is going to clarify what he wants to say. Amar Le, so Rabbi Zera says to Abaye, Shekenegdo kamane. I meant to say his opponent swears. In other words, what it calls for is that the shepherd, he's not going to actually swear, but actually the plaintiff has to swear. In other words, the people who dropped off the animals, the owners, they have to swear that they actually dropped off those animals. So the Gemara wants to explore this a little bit more and basically say to Rabbi Zera, why do you need Rabbi Chia, right? Hashtanami delete de Rabbi Chia. But even if, you know, we say Rabbi Chia, we don't accept what he had to say. Nechave means a Rav Nachman. We can say that somebody has to swear because of Rav Nachman's ruling. Why? Ditnan. We learned in a Mishnah, mana li biyatcha, right? If somebody says, you owe me a mana, and then the defendant says, ein lecha biyadi, I don't owe you anything. Patur, he's exempt. He doesn't have to swear. Va'amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman comes after seeing this particular Mishnah. This is a Mishnah in Shvuyot on page Lamed Chet on 38, right? In other words, the idea is that the defendant denies the entire claim. He doesn't have to take a Shvuah at all, okay? So, but Rav Nachman says, Mishpi'ino to Shvuat Heseit, right? There's a rabbinic enactment here. There's a rabbinic takana here that we make him take a shvuat hesed, which basically means an oath of incitement. And the idea here is the defendant who denies an entire claim against him, right, from a deoraita level, biblically, he does not need to swear. But later on, the rabbis sort of made him swear. It's called a shvuat hesed to sort of try to incite him to admit the claim if it is true, right? Because The idea there is that they still want to try to get him or sort of force him to take a shvua, with the idea being that nobody, that first of all, it would sort of, because there's going to be the shvua, right? We'd, you know, the plaintiff would sort of make sure, it would make sure that the plaintiff wouldn't sort of just make a claim that wasn't true, right? And you know, so the rabbis wanted to make sure that also we want to make sure that the defendant isn't lying in a way. So the rabbi still wanted the defendant to take an oath. So either this will make the defendant admit his debt, you know, that he owes something rather than having to swear falsely, or it establishes some credibility to him that he denies because he actually agreed to take the oath. So their point here is you don't even need Rabbi Chiya, Rabbi Zeira. You can just use the case of Rav Nachman. Like, you don't need to talk about Rabbi Chiya at all. So Rav Chiya takantaki. So the Gemara says that this oath that Rav Nachman is talking about is it's a takana of the rabbis, right? The takanta l'takanta lo avidinan, right? But we don't have one enactment after another. So therefore, if we just adopt Rabbi Chiya's ruling, right, that in other words, the shepherd has to take an oath, a shvua, because of moda b'miksat, okay, then how could we say that the oath actually goes to the townspeople? In other words, it doesn't really make sense when you invoke this thing of Rav Nachman, right? We can't say that we're shifting the oath, right, from the defendant to the, shifting the oath from the defendant to the plaintiff is rabbinic, okay? But you can't then say, but therefore you can't say that the initial oath itself is rabbinic. In other words, Rabbi Zeira's understanding, right, where he says, no, the oath is actually go to the plaintiff. The idea there is that because there's like a moda b'miksat, right, initially, the oath was with the defendant, but it gets shifted to the plaintiff, and that's rabbinic, okay? But here, what we're trying to say that Rav Nachman does here, okay, is that initially, the initial oath is actually rabbinic, okay? And that, you know, that we can't actually have to shift here. So the Gemara now says how, why Abaye would actually object to Rabbi Zeira that this shepherd couldn't swear, right, because of his status as a thief, because even if he's not a confirmed thief, right, it's only, even if he hadn't been a confirmed thief, right, he is still disqualified from swearing. V'tipukle dehave le'ro'eh, right, it should come out that the shepherd is disqualified from swearing because he is a shepherd. V'amar Rav Yehuda stam ro'eh pasul, an ordinary shepherd is disqualified from being a witness. In other words, when Abaye says to Rabbi Zeira, right, you know, how could the shepherd have to swear at all? Actually, the better objection, or really the thing that we should be, Abaye's objection doesn't even make sense, because we actually have the statement from Rav Yehuda that a shepherd, right, is disqualified as a shepherd is disqualified as a witness, even if there isn't any evidence that he's a thief, because we assume that shepherds probably allow their animals to graze in other people's fields. And that's stealing. So in other words, shepherds are in a category of people, we don't trust them. So the Gemara says, lo kasha, this isn't a difficulty. Hadidei, this ruling that an ordinary shepherd is disqualified applies when the animals that he grazes are his own. Hada alma, but this case of Rabbi Zeira, which was a shepherd who grazed the animals of the general public, right, of other people, this type of shepherd, it's not so clear, okay, that he actually is disqualified, because essentially what our understanding is that a person is only going to sin unless he has something to gain from it. So in other words, a shepherd will graze his own animals in somebody else's fields because he profits from it, right? His animals are going to be fed. But somebody who's watching other people's animals to eat, right, like this type of public shepherd who's basically just paid for the time that he cares for the animals that are given to him, he doesn't gain anything by letting those animals graze, in other people's fields. So the public shepherd wouldn't necessarily be disqualified. So then the Gemara says, "Di lo teimahachi." For if you do not say this, that there is this distinction between a private shepherd and a public shepherd, right? Or rather, we say that all shepherds are thieves and we don't trust them at all. Anan chivata l'roa hechi masrinan. Then how do we allow ourselves to entrust our animals to a public shepherd at all? In other words, the whole idea that this whole case is predicated on, that people were giving their animals to a shepherd, and there was a witness there to say, oh, we know that witnesses were there to say, you know, watch the animals being given over. But the idea that you could use a public shepherd at all, v'hakatif lifnei yiver lo titein mechshol, right? The Torah says, and this is a very famous pasuk from Vayikra chapter 19, verse 14, which says, don't place a stumbling block in front of the blind. But basically, we interpret this to usually mean, don't create a situation, right, where somebody, you know, that will cause somebody to sin, right? Like, we're thinking this is like being morally blind, that we don't cause somebody to stumble. So if we know that all shepherds are thieves, right, then you wouldn't even be allowed to give a public shepherd your animals, because the assumption is that the shepherd, of course, is going to allow those animals to graze somewhere else. So that would fall under Lifnei Iver, Lo Titech Mechshol. Ela Chazaka in Adam Chotev Lo. Rather, there's a presumption that a person does not sin if they do not get any benefit. And therefore, the public shepherd is not considered, is not presumed to actually be a thief. So I think we have two very interesting things here. And I'm going to go a little bit out of order. First of all, I think this end discussion here about the nature, first, this, I'm going to say there's three interesting things here. First of all, this whole status and this category of a shepherd, that a private shepherd is someone who's generally not trustworthy and we can't accept as a witness, is interesting. The second piece is this understanding of lifnei iver lo titein mechshol, right? That we see its broad application here in this passage of the Gemara. And third, that we finally see, and I know I'm sort of working backwards through the Gemara here, but we see an actual application of Rabbi Chiya's idea that when there's a moda b'miksat situation, right, somebody may need to take a shvua, but it's interesting to see that to Rabbi Zeira, it's not the defendant, but it's actually going to be the plaintiff. And that's like an interesting application of what Rabbi Chiya is saying here.